Morgan's 40 Under 40 Series.
Hi, it's Chris Titley here. As part of the Morgan's 40 Under 40 podcast series, I'm joined by Steve Moore. Steve, thanks so much for coming to the studio and having a chat.
No worries, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Steve, can you give us a bit of a background about your involvement in rugby and how it all began?
Yeah, so mate, to take it right back, I suppose, my rugby career started in a small town in central Queensland called Mount Morgan, where my family had moved from Ireland, the west coast of Ireland, to Mount Morgan. So not sure why the decision was made by my parents to migrate to...
It's a mining town, isn't it?
Yes, it's a very old gold mining town. The mine was still active, actually, when we lived there. But so Mum took me down to the end of the street to the little rugby club, Mount Morgan Rugby Club, and I started playing when I was 5 years old. So, and I guess I've been playing ever since, up until when I retired just last December. So that's where it all started, running around in central Queensland with bare feet. We used to get on the bus of a Saturday morning and head up to Rockhampton, to the Big Smoke, as it was then, and take part in the local competition there. So it wasn't really, I guess, till I left school and started going to university that I ever contemplated, you know, a career in rugby.
And at the time when you're growing up, I mean, it was an amateur sport probably, and then when you left school it was professional. And when did you think, I mean, you mentioned post-school that there's a potential chance of being a professional rugby player. When did that kind of in your brain think, oh, there's a chance here?
Mm. Yeah, I do remember that time. It was not about 96 and I came down from Rocky with my dad to go and watch the Wallabies play the All Blacks at the old Lang Park. And that was, of course, the first year rugby turned professional. So that was a pretty big moment in the history of the game, particularly in Australia, where you could then, you know, train full time. People earned a salary from rugby, and you got match payments and all this sort of stuff. So it wasn't really until I left university. I was playing Colts at University of Queensland under 19s, and we had quite a good team, and we went through a season undefeated. And there was about five of us that got invited to have sort of training contracts with the Reds. Senior squad, and that was really the start of, for me, being a professional athlete and being a professional player. And it probably did take me a few years in that environment to sort of fully get my head around the fact that I could do this full time, and I still studied for a lot of that period, particularly those early days. And then, you know, probably around 2005 I started to play regularly for the Reds, and that's when I made my test debut that year as well, and sort of the next 12 or 13 years was sort of taken up by that.
In terms of progression in your rugby career, I mean, playing for the Reds would have been a major milestone, playing for the Wallabies a major milestone, captaining the Wallabies a major milestone. I mean, did you ever have a big vision that you ever wanted to captain the Wallabies, play for the Wallabies, or was it just, oh, I want to play for the Reds or nothing at all?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think once you get to one stage, you dream and have goals about the next stage. And I'm really big on having dreams and heroes and things like that. I had posters of people like Steve Waugh and Ben Tune, for example, on my wall when I was a kid. Cricket was a big part of my life when I was young. I played a lot of cricket in central Queensland and also at school. And I really had dreams of playing for my country and representing my family and things like that. But until it actually happens, it is just a dream, you know, and that's certainly how it was for me. And when I first played for Queensland, we still played at Ballymore, so that was, you know, a pretty cool thing to do. And looking back now, it seems like a long time ago since the Reds ever played there full time. But I remember playing my first run-on game for Queensland at Ballymore against Wellington. And there was a full house, and that kind of atmosphere was pretty special, you know. And those kind of things are what dreams are made of, you know. They're the kind of things you really, you look into the future and think, could that ever be me one day? And it was the same playing my first test. I played my first test in Sydney in 2005 against Samoa. And when you pull that jersey on for the first time and you get presented with your cap after the game, those kind of things are surreal at the time. You never think they're going to happen, and when they do, it's pretty special.
And from a dream to a reality, there is a gap, and through that gap there's a lot of adversity, a lot of setbacks. I mean, can you talk about some of those setbacks in your career, or whether you actually said, well, that's enough, I don't want to play rugby anymore, for instance?
Yeah, look, you're dead right. It never goes in a straight line. And it's like anything in life. You work hard for it. You don't go forward non-stop. There's setbacks, things like injuries. And I probably spent 3 years in the Red squad before I ever got a game. I think I played two games in my first 4 years because there was two hookers already in the squad that were older and more experienced, and they were selected ahead of me. So you do have to put in the time and the hard work. And look, I think that hard work is probably the first thing you have to get right is just having that work ethic and that desire to want to work hard to achieve great things. And it's no different in what I'm doing now or in business, that hard work, it's the obvious things that are really important.
And where do you think that you got that mentality from? Was that from your parents? Was that from seeing other athletes, talking to other athletes in terms of the work ethic?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of everything, isn't it? All the influences you have in your life, whether it's your family, your close friends, your mentors, school teachers, club coaches, all those kind of people have an impact on you, and some more than others. And someone who I always remembered fondly was Alec Evans, and he coached me at school and also at the Reds and at the Wallabies. So I was very lucky to be coached by someone like him who placed such a big emphasis on those things like work ethic and resilience and just having a really tough mindset when you go out on the field. And I think I carried that forward in my career, and I hope when I came to the time to retire that I hopefully left some of that for the next generation of players to take forward.
And the role of becoming captain of the Wallabies, how did that change, I suppose, in terms of you've reached the potentially the top of the tree, but obviously then you've got to want to win World Cups, you want to go a bit higher. Did that change your perspective on things being captain as opposed to just a player? Because then you've got this overlay of press and overlay of attention.
Yeah, definitely. There's no doubt that role really changes the landscape completely. When you're not the captain, even though you might be part of the leadership group, you really focus on your own preparation, getting that right. And I felt like I was in a really good place around that. Having played a number of test matches, I'd really got my preparation spot on and I knew what I had to do to play well. But when you become the captain or a leader in any team, you've got to step back and look at the greater picture and the needs and wants of everyone in the team, the team dynamics, the team culture, you know, what the pulse of the team is doing, things like that. And that is really different because it takes away that time that you used to spend on yourself and preparing yourself. So that took some time to get used to that. And I think for any leader in any leadership position, that does take time to get your head around. So you've got to continue to prepare well yourself personally, but then you've got to focus on the team and the whole and the dynamics and how that all works well together. And from my experience, that's what good leaders do.
You mentioned that word, culture. I mean, that's talked about a lot in sport. It's talked a lot about in business, and it's led from the front. I mean, what sort of culture did you implement at the Wallabies or hope to have implemented as a legacy in terms of culture?
Yeah, I think we tried to identify, you know, what our identity was as a team as opposed to necessarily the Wallabies over the history of the game. And that's a really important dynamic because we had a lot of players in our team who weren't necessarily brought up in that very traditional Australian upbringing. We had a very diverse group of people in the team, people from all over the world in terms of where they were born and where their families had come from. So we had to take time to really identify what the Wallabies meant to that team and to us as a team and what was important and what we wanted people to see when they watched us play or interacted with us, whether it was on a flight at an airport, down in the shopping centre, around at a coffee shop. For me it was one and the same. So how you conduct yourself off the field is exactly the same as how you conduct yourself on the field, around some of those key values around humility and respect and things like that. That becomes part of your life, not just what you do on the field or at training or when you walk in the front gate at the club. And that's probably the biggest thing I tried to impart on the team, was that this is a whole of life, this is part of who you are type mentality, and we want people to respect us for everything we do, and we want to be humble in everything we do. And then of course there's things like communication and trust and those sort of things that are critical to a good team functioning. You've got to have really good, honest conversations. You need good leadership. You know, the captain's one part of the team, but it's the leadership team that really drives the culture. So I was very lucky in my time as captain to have, you know, a critical mass of leaders in the team that really helped me get the job done and got a good pulse of how everyone in the team was operating. And that is absolutely critical. You cannot do it, no matter what area you're in, you cannot do it on your own, and you shouldn't try.
And along that way, did you have any mentors that you sort of went outside the camp to say, look, I'm in a situation here, what would you do?
Yeah, definitely. And I used Michael Checker for that as well as a coach. We had a really good relationship. And, you know, I was pretty late in my career when I became captain. So I was a fairly mature captain in terms of, I think when I became captain, I'd played 70 or 80 tests. So I was pretty across what needed to happen to perform at that level. So I was able to develop a really strong relationship with Michael as a coach and also my other fellow teammates, particularly the leadership group. Players like Michael Hooper, who's now the captain, David Pocock, Matt Giddo, Adam Ashley Cooper, Drew Mitchell, people like that who had played a lot of rugby, and I really tapped into those guys to really form that strong team.
In terms of goal setting within a team, I mean, looking at a World Cup coming up or looking at a particular event that you're wanting to win, there's a lot of hurdles and steps along that way. How do you go about preparing for that, say a year out or 2 years out or 3 years out? Is it every weekend's, you know, you've got to keep doing the things you're doing, or in the back of your mind you're like, oh, well, we lost this game, but we've still got a chance to win the World Cup, for instance?
Yeah, that's interesting, and I think that sort of thing probably falls more to the coach and his staff around planning. For me as captain of the team, my goal was to win every game, and that's it.
Week in, week out.
Rugby, test match rugby is about winning. It's not a development team, or the Wallabies is the national team. It's the best team available for every given test, and I know Michael Checker takes that view. And it's up to him to bring young players through and pick them when he thinks they're ready to perform in a test. And he will never pick someone if he doesn't think they can do the job in that test match on the weekend. So for me as a captain, or as a player for that matter, it was about winning the test match that weekend and what you had to do that. And of course there's cultural things that have to happen all the time throughout the, you know, your time in the team and throughout a year or a season. But you get judged every weekend on your performance, and I never really got my head around, you know, having sort of courageous losses, or we played well but we lost, or that sort of stuff. I don't really think that came into my psyche when I played. I just wanted to, you know, win the game on the weekend, and if we didn't win, then that wasn't the result we were after, no matter how well we might have played.
Yep. And now that you've left rugby, what are you up to?
Yeah, so I retired in December last year, so I had a couple of months off over Christmas and all that sort of time, and probably moved a bit of my weight around to different places. You know, it's amazing what happens when you give up rugby. You know, you've actually got to find time to exercise and things like that, and that's really a big challenge. You know, that's something for the last 16 years, I've basically done that full time, and I can really resonate with people now when they say, oh, I've got to go to gym before work or after work, or wake up early and things like that. So you really, you know, you enter the real world in every sense of the word, I suppose. And I started working at the end of January for a company called the North Australian Pastoral Company, which is a cattle company. We've got 15 cattle properties all around Northern Australia and Queensland and the Northern Territory. We've got a bit over 200,000 head of cattle, so we breed and grow and sell animals into the domestic and export market. So NAPCO sits under the QIC Global Private Capital portfolio, so you know, it's well documented. QIC made an investment 2 years ago into agribusiness, and NAPCO was that company that they invested in. So it's a big investment for QIC, not just financially, but for their brand and everything that goes with that. I think it's a really courageous decision, because, you know, agriculture is probably not a traditional investment for that type of investment vehicle. And, you know, it's a very cyclical industry. You know, you've got things, as we're seeing at the moment, topical with drought. So there's a lot of variables at play there. So it's been really interesting and a real challenge. But I do really feel strongly that if we can get it right in this sector, that there's great opportunities, not just for NAPCO, but for the industry in general.
Absolutely. And where did that interest come from in terms of agriculture? Was that from your upbringing?
Well, not really, actually. I'd been talking to Damien Frawley at QIC throughout my last year of playing rugby. And he's been an amazing mentor for me in terms of advice and where to, you know, sort of start my corporate life, I suppose. Or, you know, because the way I look at it, this is my first job, you know, that I've ever had. I've been so lucky to do what I loved for so long in terms of playing rugby and all that went with that. And I never saw that as a job, even though I did it full time. It wasn't something that I ever thought of as a job. So to be in this kind of routine now has been great and something different and a really good challenge. So I am interested in the industry. I obviously grew up in Rockhampton, so I had a lot of people around me up there that were on cattle properties. So I would have spent a fair bit of time as a young fella up there on cattle property. So I sort of understand the industry to a little degree, but there's been a big learning curve in the last 6 months, getting my head around how it works and also, you know, how the corporate side of it works as well. So it's been a big learning curve, but I've been really lucky in this business that I've got to see a lot already, and that's something I've really, really enjoyed.
Just like sport and a number of startups that I interviewed, there's a sort of a technology overlay in terms of innovation. Can you talk about maybe some of the tech that you've seen in agriculture? Because it's a big market here in Australia, and we're probably at the forefront to develop amazing technology in agriculture.
Absolutely, and it's at that point now where it's really starting to become something that can be of real benefit. I think you always go through that trial phase with new technology, or does it work? How's it going to help me? All those kind of questions. Mm. Now we're starting, the rubber's hitting the road a little bit around some of this technology that we can take forward in the industry. You know, there's a hell of a lot of things like drone technology, for example. There's herd management systems with ear tags and GPS data and things like that are going to really help us make better decisions around what we do, because in the past some of these decisions maybe have been made on
the fly sort of, or normally.
Exactly. And not that that's a bad thing. There's been a lot of good work done with that system, but data, the more data we can capture, the better decisions we can make, you know. So if you've got data to prove something or disprove it, then you can make a decision based on that data. And I think we're in a process now at NAPCO of identifying, you know, what data is available to us, how we're going to collect it, and how that can really help us make better decisions, because it's around efficiency and things like that, really, that the outcomes are going to come to life. Because you know, anything that you can measure, you can sort of rationalise and be more efficient around what you do.
Work smarter, not harder. So
that's right, and also the scale of this operation. You know, we're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of acres of country, and if we can make that feel a little bit smaller through our visibility around data, then that's going to help us all, particularly when we're in Brisbane. Because sometimes when you're in Brisbane in a company like this, it is hard to understand fully what's going on out in the bush, because it's a very different environment, different people, communication is hard, connectivity is a challenge. So this is all going to help our industry, and not just NAPCO, but the whole industry is going to benefit. And we've got a small farming operation outside in the Darling Downs in Bowenville. And just to see the technology available in terms of weed management and camera technology and all that, it's really amazing. And the efficiencies that we can get in that are really incredible.
Mm. And automation to come, a lot of machine learning as well.
That's right.
Down the track as well.
Yeah.
Just on a personal level, Steve, coming from the job that you said that wasn't a job to now the job that is a job, what's the change been like? You know, you've got less travel, potentially, obviously, international travel, but you're seeing a lot of different operations. But yeah, coming in and doing the same thing pretty much 5 days a week, is it a challenge?
Oh, look, it's certainly different, and it is a challenge, and that's what I wanted. I knew it was going to be like that. I think I've been lucky, as I said, to get to experience a lot of different parts of the business. So my job is very diverse, and I have a lot of different relationships with different people that are really interesting, whether it's a station manager or someone at QIC or a board member or my, you know, fellow colleagues in the office. So there's lots of variation in the role, which has been really, really good. And I suppose the biggest challenge, as I said before, is physically it's different. You know, I'm used to running around outside and being out in the sun and sweating and all that sort of stuff. And now I've got to go and seek that out. You know, I've got to go to the gym or go for a run or things like that. I know it sounds a bit funny, but that's something that I just have never had to really plan or think about, you know. So that is the big difference. So,
and the work-life balance?
Yeah, it's good, mate. I'm travelling a little bit during the week because a lot of our properties are fairly remote, but I'm finding myself home most weekends now, which is a complete shift to what it was like in my previous life. So I think you forget how much time you spend doing that, the rugby part. You know, it's just between travel, mental preparation, physical preparation, game day, recovery, Now, that whole process is very time consuming for the athlete, but also for your family. So I've got three young kids now, so it's been really good to spend time with them on the weekends and be able to go to birthday parties and sport and just chill out at home and kick a footy around the backyard. You know, things like that I've missed, you know, and my kids are getting to that age now where they really need that, and it's nice to be able to do it.
Do you still follow rugby intimately? Do you sort of take a step back? Do you get involved in game day? Do you feel like you want to be out there again?
I don't feel like I want to be out there again. I was really at peace with my decision last year. I thought about it long and hard. I had a good chat to Michael Checker about it. And I physically couldn't commit to doing it anymore. My body was at a point where I was finding it very difficult to train. And if I couldn't do that as a leader, train properly and train at the intensity that, you know, we were talking about playing at, then it wasn't a place for me in the team. And when I reached that conclusion, it was definitely time for me to hang up the boots and move on. So, I'm at peace with that, and I look out there now and think, I don't know how I did that for so long, the physicality and that sort of stuff. I watched the recent Ireland series, and look, I've got involvements in and around the place, but largely I've taken a step back this year. I think it was really important for me, after doing something for 16 years, that I really had a break mentally, not just physically from rugby. Still keep in touch with them, of course. Still watch all the games.
Friends for life,
Yeah, that's right. And even like club rugby, you know, I've been down to university a few times and watched the game the other day on the internet, the major semi that they won. So you do start to keep
connecting. Remember that Colts team, actually, just on that topic? I think you had maybe four or five Wallabies.
Yeah, I think there was. Ended up being at least that in the team. And, yeah, it was a pretty special group of people to be involved with. So, you know, it's nice to go back to the club now and look at the old photos on the wall and back when I had a full head of hair, which was a fair while ago. But, you know, the club rugby is a great thing, isn't it? You know, you can go down on a Saturday afternoon and catch up with your mates and watch your team play. And that's where that tribalism exists in the game. And we really need to continue to explore how we can really build on that whilst also making the game commercially viable. You know, Super Rugby is an issue at the moment, but that is our commercial vehicle that sort of generates revenue for the game outside of the Wallabies. So, you know, it's easy to say we need to get rid of it or change it, but you've got to make sure that it's a commercially viable model that we can still actually be a professional game in Australia, you know, because club rugby is great, but it's not necessarily the commercial vehicle that's going to drive revenue.
Yep. Stephen, just one final question about some tips for entrepreneurs. I ask all my guests this, about maybe some business acumen that you've kept through your life or that you can share to aspiring business leaders, because you were at the top of your game in terms of being captain of the Wallabies and dealing with press and dealing with all those issues that you mentioned. Have you got a piece of advice out there that you could share to others?
Yeah, well,
or a couple of pieces of advice?
I don't think I can give them too much commercial acumen. I've only been sort of in commercial life, I suppose, for 6 months. But something that I've always found really important is a comment that I read a while ago, and it's that you won't get better at something by doing less of it. So I suppose you can take of that what you will, but that's pretty simple. But
it's your kids now as well, in terms of
that's right.
Reading and
you can apply it to everything in your life, and whether it's work, sport, family, any number of things. And I think that's a really simple one to live by.
Fantastic, Steve. Thanks so much for coming in for the chat. Very much appreciated. And congratulations on your career in rugby, and good luck in your career with NAPCO and in the future.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me, mate.